This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe ignored a demand from the ruling party that he step down by noon Monday. Parliament is now expected to open impeachment proceedings against Mugabe on Tuesday. But that process could be long, complex, and unsuccessful.
That's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. We'll have full details on that story coming up.
Also, Libya's deputy prime minister said he will investigate allegations of slave trading taking place in the country. And Kremlin officials say Sudan's president Omar al-Bashir will visit Moscow on Thursday, his first official trip to the Russian capital.
We'll have these stories and more for you ahead on Africa News Tonight.
When Zimbabwe's military sent tanks into the capital and took Robert Mugabe into...
Our top story this hour, Zimbabwe's longtime president Robert Mugabe is facing impeachment after making it clear in a televised speech he will not resign. Millions tuned in to radio and television yesterday expecting to celebrate the end of what has been 37 years of Mugabe's autocratic rule. They were bitterly disappointed, some to the point of tears, to hear Mugabe claim he will preside over a ZANU-PF party congress next month. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
When Zimbabwe's military sent tanks into the capital and took Robert Mugabe into custody, it was clear they wanted a quick resolution to the growing discontent with the longtime president. But nearly a week later, with Mugabe refusing to resign and parliament threatening to impeach him, they could be on a long and complicated path with a formidable opponent, Mugabe himself. Lovemore Maduku teaches law at the University of Zimbabwe. He says impeachment can be very complex because it is meant to be more than just lawmakers voting out an unpopular leader by a two-thirds vote.
When we say an impeachment in the Zimbabwean context, it actually means a trial. You are accusing the president of something, and then you want them tried for that. If you find them guilty of that thing that you have accused them of, you then dismiss them from being president. You can't do it in one day or in a few minutes or whatever. It takes several months to complete an impeachment.
Zimbabwe's constitution provides four grounds for impeaching a president: serious misconduct, failure to obey, uphold, or defend the constitution, willful violation of the constitution, or inability to perform the functions of the office because of physical or mental incapacity. Maduku says a lawyer might see several opportunities there. Mugabe is widely accused of human rights abuses and clamping down on civil liberties during his 37-year reign. But he said politicians may take other factors into account. For example, Maduku says it is unlikely that the ruling ZANU-PF party would risk hurting its stature by highlighting actions that elevated the party to prominence, such as Gukurahundi, the series of army-led massacres of political and ethnic rivals in the 1980s.
If they get him on that, then they are exposing him to that whole issue about, you know, crimes against humanity and so forth. And I don't think that ZANU-PF is currently constituted would want that end to President Mugabe. They are themselves beneficiaries of his leadership.
But these considerations clash with the increasingly loud demands of Zimbabwe's people. During the weekend, tens of thousands of Harare residents marched, demanding Mugabe's immediate resignation. On Monday, Chris Mutsvangwa, head of the influential War Veterans Association, said demonstrations would continue until, in his words, Mugabe's back is seen by the people of Zimbabwe. But Maduku says the military may have underestimated Mugabe and his familiarity with the law.
Even as we move from stage to stage, there's so many things that they are not aware of. In terms of the law, I'm sure that's why they obviously lost the boardroom discussions, because on the legal side, Mugabe is always on the stronger side.
The impeachment process, he notes, allows the president to defend himself against the charges. Mugabe has never been one to shy away from a fight, and as the only leader independent Zimbabwe has ever had, this is one he has spent decades training for. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Anita. And we now have in studio with us our colleague from the Zimbabwe service, Gibbs Dube. Thank you, Gibbs, for joining us again today.
Thank you, Kim.
Now, we were talking about the impeachment there. So what is the next step to get this process going?
So now Parliament is supposed to actually convene perhaps tomorrow. And then they have to set up a committee of nine, which has to, you know, comprise the ZANU-PF party and the MTC. You know, they are sort of like having a majority in terms of ZANU-PF. So what then happens from there is they have to investigate the president. So if the investigation, is actually instituted tomorrow, it will take a while for him to be impeached. So meaning that at the end of the day, it all depends on what the president is going to say. He has got a right, according to the Constitution, to say, you know, you guys, you are investigating me on these issues, but I don't agree with you. And then he can take the matter to court. And so, which means it's a long, long, long process. And people were expecting, you know, from the ground that the president will go tomorrow. But it's not the case. You know, I was talking to a constitutional lawyer, Machobana Ngobe, was saying, people were actually blinded about the whole thing. So the army itself, like what even Mr. Maduk is saying, the army most probably misread the constitution. And to make matters worse, the people that convened the ZANU-PF Central Committee meeting, some of them were not members of the party. So the Central Committee can only be convened by the secretary and president of the party, which happens to be Mr. Mugabe. So what happens now is we are going to see a lot of confusion from these guys that have started this process. So which means that even if there is this kind of agreement among everybody that the president should be impeached, the law is the law. It will take a while, you know.
In the meantime, will President Mugabe remain president?
Definitely, he's still the president of Zimbabwe. Yesterday, he was saluted by the securocrats, as you saw it, and they actually respect him that he's still the president of the country, as long as you are saluted, which means you are still the president. And he presented himself as the president of Zimbabwe, and actually praised them, you know, for always doing good things, and also praised war veterans, but acknowledging that there are problems that are affecting the country. So, which means that at the end of the day, you know, he's in agreement with them that there's a problem. But the icing of everything that Mugabe said was that he's going to chair over the coming Congress of the party, where they're going to choose a new leadership. Are they going to remove him or not? Then that becomes another matter.
And at the same time, what is the vice president doing during this time?
So, in fact, as we speak right now, Mr. Mnangagwa is not the vice president of Zimbabwe. He was fired. So what has to happen is for him to be sworn in afresh before he takes over that position. So if he's not sworn in, he's a pedestrian like Gibbs. You know, he's like me and you, you know. So he's not the vice president of Zimbabwe. That's another big question. So will Mr. Mugabe accept the kind of move to sway him in? That's not going to happen. So when then you look at the other vice president, Phelekezela Mpoko, we don't even know where he is right now. The country is on autopilot. So there's a big crisis than what people may be seeing here. So which means Emmerson Mnangagwa may be outside the country, and then we have Mr. Phelekezela Mpoko. He's nowhere to be found. So who's running the country right now? Nobody.
Well, isn't the military, are they calling the shots right now?
They are calling the shots, but are they really literally doing what is supposed to be done, running the government? So the government is suffering. There's no one in charge. So maybe I can walk in there and run it.
Yeah, I don't think you would want that, though.
I don't think so.
So looking just at the people on the ground, what is going on the ground? I know there are demonstrations going on. Will these continue? Do you think there'll be any violence?
Now, what is happening is the war veterans are saying they're going to be camping at State House. So they're going there to camp and trying to force the president to leave. Maybe they're going to have some kind of surprise. He won't even acknowledge that they're around. He'll just ignore them. They'll be toying, doing all those kind of things, but he'll still be the president. In terms of violence, I don't anticipate any violence. One factor is the police have been neutralized. Those are the people that have been causing a lot of, you know, consternation. I mean, people have been unhappy about how police are handling, you know, protests. So the army is in charge of everything. So as the army is in charge and is in control of the state apparatus, which means that they cannot allow people to be violent. So which means, and people even like them, you know. At the end of the day, we saw even some members of the public, you know, embracing the army, which means there's no violence at all.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for this insight, Gibbs. I appreciate it, and we'll look forward to you coming back again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lewis. Thank you.
Kenya's Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that Uhuru Kenyatta won last month's presidential election, striking down arguments that the law was not followed in conducting the repeat poll. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Chief Justice David Maraga announced the decision following 3 days of hearings.
The presidential election of the 26th October is hereby upheld, as is the election of the third respondent.
The head of the court dismissed the two petitions filed by a former lawmaker and two human rights defenders. The October vote was a rerun of the August presidential election. Uhuru Kenyatta was declared the winner of the initial vote. But the Supreme Court ruled the result was invalid because of irregularities in the transmission of vote counts. Kenyatta's main challenger, Raila Odinga, boycotted the October poll, saying the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission was not ready to conduct a credible election. The petitioners challenged Kenyatta's victory in the Supreme Court, arguing that the commission was supposed to conduct a fresh nomination process after Odinga withdrew. They also argued the election should not stand since 25 constituencies did not participate in the repeat poll. In a statement, the chairman of the Electoral Commission, Wafula Chebukati, said the unanimous decision by the court affirmed the agency's resolve and effort to conduct a free, fair and credible election. After the ruling, some Kenyatta supporters took the streets to celebrate the verdict. Mercy Njoki is one of them. I am so happy with the ruling. I waited for it for so long, and God has listened to our prayers. Another Kenyatta supporter, James Chege, wants to see the president reaching out to all citizens.
During the election, there are three groups. One, those who voted for him. Second, those who didn't vote for him. And thirdly, those who didn't go to vote.
Opposition supporter Amos Onyango was disappointed with the verdict.
I'm not happy with those judges, first of all, because judges, they make ruling is not good. Totally, the election on 26th was very bad. It's not election. It's divided election. You cannot decide who won. We have so many parts of Kenya. People didn't vote.
Protests and clashes broke out in pro-Odinga neighborhoods of Nairobi after the verdict. And on Sunday, unknown people killed at least 6 people in Nairobi. Odinga blamed the state for the killings. The police have denied the accusation and say they were investigating the deaths. Kenyatta is expected to be sworn in on November 28th. The opposition say they will not recognize his presidency and will continue to fight for what they call electoral justice. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Kremlin officials say Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir will visit Moscow on Thursday, his first official trip to the Russian capital. An aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin confirmed the visit today. He told reporters in Russia that the two presidents would meet. Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court for genocide and war crimes tied to the Darfur conflict. Despite the charges against him, Bashir has continued to travel to friendly countries. Fighting in Darfur began in 2003 when ethnic minority groups in the western region began to resist the Arab-dominated government. Aid agencies say more than 2 million people have been displaced by the fighting and at least 300,000 have died. Bashir denies the allegations of human rights abuses by his government. Well, Libya's Deputy Prime Minister Ahmed Metig said yesterday his UN-backed government of national accord will investigate allegations of slave trading taking place in the country. Libya has long been a major transit hub for migrants trying to reach Europe, and many of them have fallen prey to serious abuse in the hands of traffickers and others. The U.S. television network CNN aired footage last week of an apparent live auction in Libya where black men were presented to North African buyers as potential farmhands and sold off for as little as $400. Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the alleged slave trading in Libya.
Well, we understand that the Libyan government will investigate the slave trading, the alleged slave trading that's going on in Libya. We've had an announcement from the Deputy Prime Minister, Ahmed Mettig. He said that his UN-backed government of national accord would investigate these allegations. And then we've also had a press conference. The minister who is responsible for African affairs in Libya, Salah Mbu Rigiga, has said that he too endorses this investigation and that the Tripoli-based government, at least, is determined to get to the bottom of what has happened and investigate these allegations that we've seen in the report on CNN.
Also, the government of Niger, they're withdrawing their ambassador. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, we've seen outrage expressed right across Africa. The Senegal government has expressed its outrage at the alleged auction of sub-Saharan African migrants on Libyan soil. And Niger's president, Mahamadou Issoufou, said that the issue had made him so angry that he had called for the withdrawal of the ambassador, Niger's ambassador to Libya, to express that country's indignation and upset about this alleged slave market that's going on in Libya.
And also, Josephine, do you really think they'll be able to conduct a thorough investigation to get to the bottom of this?
Well, from what we're hearing and seeing, it seems that Libya really is in a state of chaos where the armed militias are really running the country and doing what they want with migrants. We know we have evidence of hundreds of migrants crammed into warehouses and airport hangars, being tortured, mistreated for months, often starved before they're finally put on vessels and trying to send them to Europe. But it seems really a tall order for the Libyan authorities to try and control this situation. And I'm not sure that it's inspiring any confidence, particularly from the African leaders when they have these allegations in front of them. And perhaps that's why we're seeing such an outcry from various leaders across Africa about this issue.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
The Israeli government says about 40,000 African migrants who entered the country illegally have 3 months to leave voluntarily. If they do not, they face indefinite imprisonment. According to the UN Refugee Agency, about 27,000 of the migrants are from Eritrea, about 8,000 from Sudan. The decision made yesterday doesn't say where the migrants should go. However, in the past, the Israeli government has had agreements with Rwanda and Uganda to accept migrants. About 5 years ago, a stream of migrants from Africa began entering Israel, most through Egypt. At one point, the number of migrants who had entered illegally topped 60,000. Over the past few years, that number has declined as some have moved on and others were resettled elsewhere. The UN Refugee Agency has expressed concern about the Israeli plan. It says Israel's voluntary departure program is done so secretively that UN officials are unable to monitor the situation of asylum seekers sent to other countries.
In Uganda, the media is often at loggerheads with government and especially with the security agencies. While the country has over 200 media outlets, press freedom is still wanting and journalists continue to face harassment. The government has enacted restrictive laws to keep the media under tight control. It has also set up agencies that monitor the media. Many government departments deny requests for information under the country's Access to Information Act. Other departments aid the government stifling of the media. Robert Sempala is the national coordinator of the Human Rights Network for Journalists. Reporter Halima Othmani asked him to describe the relationship between the media and the government and how the media and practitioners are coping in a restrictive environment.
Media freedom is at a very precarious state. You certainly see lots of restrictions. Free media and critical media are not good friends of this government.
We also know that the police, for example, year in, year out, from your reports, you've showed that they are the most perpetrators of injustices against journalists. How is this relation now?
We must commend the police for coming out rightly to try to address this challenge. We've had
a couple of successful meetings about trying to safeguard the journalists on the line of duty, but still that has not helped matters. The most recent action was when journalists went to cover the police residential apartments that were on fire, and then police guys started hurling stones at the journalists covering. One of them was a female journalist who was on the roof of a house nearby so as to capture the footage very well, but this person was stoned as well. This was on the directive of the police leadership. And we also know it for a fact that in many places, the police has censured what goes out to the media by not letting their different leaders talk to the media, even those at the scene of crime. It is only now a preserve of the regional police commander and the national spokesperson. And also, we've not seen the police going strongly against those people that we've pointed out as perpetrators, which would be a deterrent for committing crimes against journalists.
The police argue that they're being misrepresented, journalists are misquoting them. If the police says at the crime scene, this did not happen, why are the journalists saying otherwise? Do you think journalists are also misunderstanding the police?
I think there's no such a thing like misunderstanding the police. And that is a very lame excuse for attacking journalists on the line of duty. Even if they are being misrepresented on the factual front, doesn't warrant batons and tear gassing journalists, confiscating their gadgets and destroying them and even charging them on trumped up charges. If a journalist is at fault, get them to court and let them be heard. If a journalist is misrepresenting the facts, then what are the other facts that are not brought out? The problem stems practically from police trying to conceal a lot of information. We certainly know that police has defrauded so many people, detained people beyond the mandatory hours of 48, taken money from suspects, and frustrated investigations into sensitive cases and even ordinary cases that are brought to them by very poor people. And that is practically what police is hiding away from the public. You cannot justify that by telling a journalist to, you know, report in the interest of the police. Journalists are supposed to be independent. So if they must please the police, then we don't have any media to talk about.
What kind of reforms do you want to see in the media industry in Uganda?
One, we want to see a media-friendly legal framework. We do not have to work in an environment that is littered with so many restrictive and incriminating clauses within our legal framework, because that certainly criminalizes all the work that is being done by the media.
That was Robert Sempala, National Coordinator, Human Rights Network Uganda. He spoke with reporter Halima Othmani from Kampala, Uganda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Blended sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee it.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.